Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your co-host, Alan Cardoza, and with me is my co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek.
For those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much.
And please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. till noon Pacific time, this show will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases, entertain.
While bringing answers and options to making your lives happier, healthier, and more successful.
Now, this show will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more.
We're going to introduce you to talented authors, new innovations in the area of health, security, and fun for you and your family.
Now, with our experience working with families in crisis, we've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, Matt, I know I'm looking forward to this particular guest, and I believe you are too. The subject is anxiety, and I feel it's one of those things that so many of us are having to deal with. I mean, as life is sped up, as there's more anxiety for all of us, as there's more pressure put on us, I think it's something that a lot of people deal with. And I was looking for some statistics on this, and I noticed that the Child Mind Institute's 2015 report stated that 80% of kids with diagnosable anxiety disorder are not getting treatment. Has that been your findings?
Wow, very scary statistic, but actually it doesn't really surprise me. We all deal with anxiety in our lives, and unfortunately it becomes just a disorder at some point, and unfortunately it's really not getting treated in our society. I remember someone telling me once that when we think of the past, we can get depressed, and when we look forward to the future, it's when we get anxious. But these disorders are very real. I was dropping off my daughter back to school, Eden. You know, it's back to school season, and she was going into first grade, and as I'm taking her to school, she's grabbing my leg, and we get the tears, and she's really nervous and anxious and, you know, shedding tears. And so having this conversation today about adolescent anxiety, it really is, it's important, and I think it's a necessary thing. As a child psychologist, most of this stuff I understand to be really normal, but really the job today and for all of us is to figure out when it's normal and when it's not, and when we really need to intervene. We know anxiety is the most common mental illness. Over 40 million Americans suffer from it, or at least some form of a diagnosable anxiety disorder, and 1 in 8 children have anxiety disorder. So the real question is, you know, what happens if it goes untreated? And the obvious kind of things would be the quality of life for a kid, grades, socialization. You're smiling, Alan.
No, I'm smiling because you were talking about the anxiety that your daughter's going through. But what about the anxiety you were going through taking her to first grade?
You're right. You know, I think it was probably bigger. And you know, they talk about projecting feelings onto kids. So I'm sure she could feel daddy's fears and nervousness. It's a tough time for parents, you know, especially with young ones. And we think, you know, it's no big deal. But in 1995 and through 97, Kaiser Permanente did a study called the Adversive Childhood Experience Study. It's called the ACE study. And it was probably the most profound study that our field has ever had. It looked at like 17,000 members. And basically what Kaiser found out, and eventually CDC took the study over because it was so kind of scary, is that children that have adversive childhood experiences such as anxiety, depression, and stuff like that, later in life have earlier deaths, are more prone to disease, have social emotional difficulties, and cognitive impairments. So this is such a serious and real problem. It's not even really within just our country. You know, a lot of diseases and mental health stuff we can blame on iPads and society and social, but anxiety is actually, you know, really an international problem. It's about 10% 80% of our population, and also most of Western Europe's. We look at other countries such as the Middle East and Asia, and they still have about 6 to 8% of the population dealing with anxiety. So, you know, this is a very real problem. It's one we deal with day to day. There's misconceptions about it. People think that, you know, just taking a pill is the answer, or that, you know, because we're stressed or have anxiety, we should avoid certain situations. But the truth is that we need to deal with this. And as your statistic showed us earlier, we're not handling it in the appropriate way. And that's why I'm really excited to bring on today's guest, who is an expert in the field of adolescent anxiety, Dr. Young. Dr. Young is the director of the clinical program development and outreach at Mountain Valley Treatment Center. His primary responsibility is building strong relationships with health professionals who treat anxiety and obsessive compulsive disorder.
Now, in addition, Dr. Young provides clinical consultation and training to the on-site clinical staff, to his own team. He also serves as a member of the admissions committee and believes that his participation helps ensure that appropriate candidates for treatment are approved for enrollment. Now, Dr. Young completed his pre-doctoral training at the Edith Norris Rogers Memorial Veterans Hospital and his postdoctorate fellowship at Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates. Alex, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I think one of the areas that we should probably start, now we've talked a little bit about some of the statistics and everything, but I don't know that we've gone so much into really what anxiety is, and why don't you give us what your definition of it is, and many people out there may see it a little differently, but share with us how you see it.
Sure. So I guess the first thing I like to say when I talk about anxiety is that it is a perfectly normal, natural experience. And I think, Matt, you were the one talking about Eden, right?
Correct.
Okay, so you know, Eden grabbing your leg, had a little bit of anxiety at the first day of school. I mean, totally natural, normal experience for you to be a little bit anxious, you know, letting your daughter go off to school. I think that when we talk about kind of problematic anxiety, it's when we, at Mountain Valley where I work, we might talk about that two words can kind of define it, which is what if. And then maybe what if, and then the worst case scenario you can possibly think of. And that's sort of, that's the most basic definition of anxiety. So we might also say that it's an overestimation of a problem and an underestimation of your ability to cope with that problem.
And it develops, in your opinion, almost in a natural state, correct?
Yes, and so and it is it's a normal thing. If we didn't have it, we'd probably be dead, because it is the kind of thing that saves our life on a daily basis. So I think the first thing you learn in probably a Psych 101 class, or the first thing often people remember, is that fight, flight, or freeze response. And so it is that. I think the example of the caveman who comes out of his cave and sees the tiger and says, kind of, oh crap, danger, I got to get out of here, and has that sort of, that would be the flight response. And so gets a shot of adrenaline, has to run back in his cave to avoid this tiger. That's really good. That can happen in a modern society where you step out into the road and you look up and there is a bus coming and it's really close to you and you jump out of the way. If you didn't have this anxiety response and this shot of adrenaline, and instead you thought, oh, that's a pretty bus coming at me, I mean, you'd be run over. You'd be dead. So this is a really good thing for us to have. And I think it's important to know that if we really got rid of all anxiety, it would hurt us. It's that one out of every 8 kids, or 1 out of every 4 people, just in their lifetime, will experience an anxiety disorder. So it actually anxiety that gets to the point where it could be classified as an anxiety disorder, which generally means that it's impacting their life in a very negative way and limiting them. So that's 25% of the population would have anxiety to a certain level where it qualifies as an anxiety disorder. And that can develop over the lifetime. So this is a very prevalent thing that anxiety can get to a point where we become sort of overly sensitive to anxiety, or these anxious responses are being triggered at times where your life is not in danger. You know, it might be getting up in front of a crowd to speak. It might be in social situations, and then it's not so helpful.
Now, Alex, do you believe that we are experiencing more anxiety, or are we just learning more about it, or are we in a situation to where there is so much media out there, that there's so much doom and gloom that's being put out there, that we're just, you know, it's just bringing every negative possible thing that we could have anxiety about right to our attention immediately?
So I guess a little bit of, you know, if I'm a good psychologist, I don't give a straight answer, right? I'll just say, you know, it's a little bit of everything. So yes, yes, and yes. I think that we are experiencing more anxiety, though, and I guess I would hypothesize for a couple reasons. I think life is just complicated, stressful. There's lots of kind of planning competition that goes on. I was having a conversation the other day with a friend of mine who does college admissions. And she has people calling her all the time, parents, asking about, you know, what school should I send my kid to so that they could get into your school? And that's a reasonable question. The problem is that often these parents are calling and they have a preschooler.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And it's, you know, what elementary school should my kid go to so that they can get into whatever college? And it's starting very early. And it's just, it is a pressured society. I also think that there's a generational shift, and I think it's very reasonable that each generation, I think, new parents, they want to make it a little easier on their kids, you know, a little easier than they had it. And there may be a point where it becomes a little too much in that direction. And so we talk about family accommodation at Mountain Valley. And so that might be where, and we run into a lot of cases, and we'll probably get into this later, of school avoidance. And the family accommodation is a big factor there. So I would think, you know, a generation back, two generations back, if a child said, you know, I really don't feel like going to school today, I don't feel comfortable going to school today, that kid probably got shooed out the door with a broom or got the wooden spoon until they got to school. And now I think parents have a hard time tolerating their children's discomfort.
You know,
and so they might be accommodated, and they might say, "Oh, okay, honey, you can stay home from school." And then it gets harder to go back to school.
I completely agree, and I was fascinated, you know, about 15 years ago in private practice, where parents would switch their kids' school. I mean, literally. And it's, you know, such an enabling behavior, but I think that you hit it right on the head with it's more the parents' discomfort and anxiety to deal with and to tolerate their children's moods not being cheery and happy all the time.
And isn't it interesting how it's really in the mental health sphere that pops up? It doesn't so much in the physical. You wouldn't, if you were sitting there with your kid in the ER and they had fallen down and got a cut and they needed stitches, you wouldn't stop in the middle of them getting stitches and say, "Oh, you know, that's too uncomfortable for her. she can't have those stitches anymore and just go home and say, well, you know, maybe we'll deal with this later, or let's just pause on this for a little bit. You're going to, you know it's in for the best interest of your child in the future. And it's just not that way with kind of mental health, where you know that if, you know, with anxiety, the best way that you can remain anxious, if you want to remain and maintain your anxiety, the best thing to do is avoid the thing that makes you anxious, seek some reassurance, and distract yourself whenever you feel anxious. Those are the three ingredients if you want to maintain your anxiety. And that's kind of what we do.
And that's fascinating, because I remember, you know, the old school logic of using a rubber band on your finger or avoiding situations, like I talked about a little bit in the intro. It's almost the opposite is true in true treatment and really what you want to accomplish.
Yes, exactly. And so it's really, you know, this is, we're starting to talk about behavioral therapy here. It is retraining the patient or resident, as we call them, and their family.
Yeah, and you know, Alex, I know that we talked a little bit about the fact that they're not getting the treatment, but one of the things we haven't really shared with our listeners is, you know, how would you approach, or how do you approach the treatment so that it is something that either they can deal with, or is it something that they actually just don't have to deal with anymore?
So one of the best things about working with anxiety is that anxiety is totally treatable. And you can see really fantastic results. People get better if they really engage in treatment. So the best evidence-based treatment that we've got out there is exposure and response prevention is the main go-to treatment. And basically the gist of it is sort of what we're talking about, which is it's a kind of behaviorally based mode of treatment that is facing your fears and taking away all of the kind of the safety behaviors. Now, this is not to say that you jump in the deep end of the pool. It's systematically dipping a toe in and getting comfortable step by step, easing into these anxious situations until it feels better and better, and seeing that whole what if and then the worst case scenario, that worst case scenario doesn't happen.
That's great. So what you're saying is, I mean, you're drawing from more of a behavioral or a dynamic type of system.
Yeah. So the behavioral system is really wonderful, because you also don't have to change the way somebody thinks. It's going to happen automatically. So just by engaging in some of these things, it gets easier. So I like to, when I talk to people about exposure therapy and what that looks like, corporations do it all the time when they have people who they're training to give speeches, and they send them to Toastmasters and they have them practice their toasts, and so they get more comfortable speaking in public. And that's a good example of what exposure therapy is. Kind of the more you do something, I'm sure that you guys feel it, the more you talk on the radio, probably the first time you talked on the radio, it was a little daunting. And then the more you do it, the better it feels.
Yep.
Yeah, and I've always been a big proponent of kind of the systematic, desensitized exposure response, slowly reintegrate the fear with, you know, what the stimulus is. And to me, the sad part of, and it's really our field, I feel, that's failed, is that, your program at Mountain Valley does this. But I hear all the time of a friend sending an adolescent to a therapist, and they start talking, you know, the first two sessions is all about their childhood and yada, yada, yada. And they're doing kind of more analytic work, which is wonderful in a lot of situations. But if they're there for anxiety, then we should have some sort of a national systematic way to treat anxiety, like exposure and response prevention, that, you know, obviously objectively works. But I feel like as a field, we're not all aligned.
I totally agree. And we find that we have some of our residents coming to Mountain Valley who've seen half a dozen therapists, and they've talked about their childhood, you know, till they're blue, but that doesn't, it isn't really addressing the issue. So now they it does them a disservice because now they're not really trusting of therapy. Nothing works. You know, they are too broken to be fixed, which is absolutely false. And, you know, they spend some time with us or, you know, spend some time with, let's say, a cognitive behavioral therapist who does some exposure with them. And it is amazing the results that you can see. And I think that the field is changing a little bit with some of the new literature and thinking that's coming out with exposure. Because I know, at least in my training, we weren't necessarily encouraged to do exposure-based therapy unless you had some real time flexibility. A 60-minute session, you were told you needed to do this exposure therapy, and it would trigger an anxiety response. And basically, I was told that with this anxiety response, you'd have a shot of adrenaline. You couldn't keep up that anxious response forever, and eventually it had to go away. And so you sat with your patient until that habituation occurred, until the anxiety went down. And, you know, then they would get that feeling that the anxiety went down. And unless you had sort of an infinite amount of time, that wasn't always ideal. You had a client coming the next hour, so you couldn't really do that. Now we're finding with Jonathan Abramowitz, who's a big exposure specialist out there, does a lot of the research on there with inhibitory learning. He's come out with a lot of literature, and Michelle Krask is another one, coming out with a lot of literature that's saying you don't actually have to sit there for ever. Just having a time-limited exposure therapy session where your patient is learning to tolerate the anxious feelings, that they're not going to die from the anxiety, that just tolerating their own anxiety is okay. We're seeing a lot of success and a lot of more people incorporating exposure into the therapeutic hour and getting training to do it, because all of a sudden you can do it in a 50-minute session. And that's really exciting to me.
Now, Alex, you mentioned Mountain Valley. Share with some of the listeners that may not be familiar with it exactly what Mountain Valley is and who are the young people that you're working with. What are some of the things they're going through?
Sure. So Mountain Valley is a short-term residential treatment center. And so when I say short-term, I mean kind of probably 60 to 90 days is a typical stay for us. We're very small, so we have 20 to 24 residents at a time. We serve adolescents and young adults ages 13 to 20. And we're a unique residential treatment center in that we are focused on anxiety and OCD. So that has to be sort of the primary issue that somebody is presenting with to come to Mountain Valley. And we use exposure-based cognitive behavioral therapy with our residents. And that's all we do. And so our therapists are very good at exposure-based CBT. We're located in New Hampshire, in Pike, New Hampshire, which is about 45 minutes north of Hanover, so Dartmouth College. And we're on the edge of the White Mountains. It's beautiful. We're on 1,800 acres. So if you think about 20 to 24 residents, we got a lot of space per kid.
Now you mentioned specializing in anxiety and OCD. So share with our listeners what OCD is and what it isn't.
Sure. So now some people may agree with me and some people may not, but OCD has sort of changed in terms of its categorization recently with our new diagnostic and statistical manual. It now is its own diagnosis. It used to be classified under the umbrella of anxiety disorders. So with your panic disorder, generalized anxiety, social anxiety, it was sort of lumped in there. And I think people still sort of fight about whether that should have been done or not. I think we treat it basically the same way, doing exposure-based kind of behavioral therapy. So OCD, as its name kind of says, is made up of obsessions and compulsions. And these things have to take up a lot of time and get in the way of normal functioning. So obsessions are thoughts, images, impulses that occur over and over again and feel outside of somebody's control. So an individual with OCD really doesn't want to have these thoughts. They'll often find them disturbing. And often with OCD, our residents realize that the thoughts really don't make any sense to have them over and over again. And then that's followed by, and these thoughts are produce really uncomfortable feelings. So fear, disgust, doubt, and sometimes feelings that things have to be done in sort of just the right way. And so you'll, which I guess is probably most typical when people sort of think of a colloquial OCD, you know, if they imagine somebody with OCD, they think about the person who wants something just right, has that feeling, and then the compulsion would be to do something, a behavior or a ritual that would then make that anxiety or those feelings with the obsessions subside or feel a little bit better. So the person who needs something just right, well, the compulsion may be to line things up in a particular way. So yeah, common obsessions fall into different categories. So you could have contamination. We get a lot of kids that have contamination, so it might be focused on body fluids or germs or dirt. Some other ones are losing control. So, you know, fear of acting on an impulse to harm oneself, even though they're never going to harm themselves. It just might be a thought that is happening over and over again, or fear of violence that might happen to them or that they might commit to somebody else, even though really that's not a possibility of happening. Perfectionism. There are lots more that I could go into. And then common compulsions that go with those are, so if you have a fear of contamination, a compulsion that goes with that is washing or cleaning excessively. If it's losing control, it might be checking things. So checking certain things so that you won't do harm to others, or checking that you will not harm yourself, or that you aren't having that thought, which of course makes that thought happen more. So that's sort of your basic obsessive compulsive disorder.
You know, it breaks my heart thinking of young adults having these, you know, OCD diagnosis and tendencies. Are you seeing an increase in this? The same? Are you, you know, is there any patterns you've noticed of recent?
I would say, yeah, we are seeing an increase, and maybe some of that is more that we're getting better at recognizing that it's specifically OCD, and you know, maybe before it would have been classified more as just an anxiety, and I think people are getting more educated and asking the questions. A great resource is IOCDF, which is the International OCD Foundation. So I think they're IOCDF.org. They run a conference every year, and it's probably one of the most impressive conferences I've ever been to. I've now been twice, and they have not only I don't really like the term, but they not only professionals, but they also have the consumers. They have people who are you know, who have OCD that are there, who have sought treatment or are seeking treatment, and so there are lots of families, and there might be kids running around and going to groups that are oriented towards treatment, and it's a nice feel at this conference. So for anybody out there who is wanting more information or looking for resources, they are a great resource.
All right, and if you also want to learn more about Mountain Valley Treatment, you can go to mountainvalleytreatment.org. You can get more information on what Dr. Young is talking about. We're going to take a break right now. You're listening to Answers for the Family. We will be right back. founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
Welcome back to Answers for the Family. I'm your co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek, with Alan Cardoza, and our guest today, Dr. Alex Young. Dr. Young, I was driving yesterday with Eden and a friend in the back seat, and I stopped the car suddenly. The drink spills on the kids in the back. They're screaming and yelling, and her really wonderful, cute little friend really had a hard time kind of calming down, and her dad was in the car, and we talked a little bit about it. And as the, quote, child psychologist in our group of friends, a lot of parents always come to me and say, you know, is there a problem, or when to seek help, or does she need a, you know, does she got to go see a therapist, or does she need a residential program? When you're working with families, and I know there's different levels of care, but at what point do you tell a family, or would you say to a family, you know, it's time to really start thinking about Mountain Valley or other resources?
Well, so it's an excellent question. I think that thinking about when to choose a residential treatment center, it's a hard call. It's a hard call for parents. I think it's anxiety provoking for parents, definitely. So we will work with families who are thinking about residential treatment, and if we don't think that the family is ready, we will definitely tell them. I think most of our residents have tried outpatient therapy, so residential is sort of a higher level of care. A lot of our residents will have tried outpatient therapy. They may be sort of at the point with their anxiety that they are they're avoiding most things in life. So we will have kids who are refusing to go to school, and maybe they have seen a therapist for a little while, but they're having a really hard time going, or if they are going, they don't go consistently, they might go late. And so really there isn't that progress or traction happening in therapy. And so with us, somebody comes to us, they're living with us for 60 to 90 days. Typically, if they really don't want to kind of get with the program, we can kind of wait them out. We don't have a level system. We don't... we're not punishing kids if they don't want to do the program, but we can kind of they'll be a little bored for a little while, and then I think the most powerful part of our residential program is that we have this very narrow focus, so everybody has a similar issue, and the issues associated with being anxious and anxiety, typically these adolescents and young adults, their lives have gotten smaller and smaller. Their world has narrowed, and to the point where you sort of feel like you're the only person that's got this issue. And so having a residential program where everybody has similar issues is really helpful, because it normalizes the struggles with anxiety. It also leverages having a peer group. If you're an anxious kid and your parents are telling you to go somewhere or do something, it's very easy to avoid that. If your peers are telling you that they want you to go somewhere or do something, or you know, come with them on this activity, that's a whole different ballgame. Mm-hmm. Typically, people will rise to that occasion just to save face. So we can sort of leverage our group in a therapeutic way to get kids to engage in treatment.
I mean, it makes perfect sense. Now, what I'd like to do is I'd like to share. I'm looking at an instant message that's coming across right now, and it's a question. We were talking a little bit about OCD, and this one reads, I have read OCD is a different disorder, but related to anxiety disorder. Is OCD a precursor, or can OCD be a result of having an anxiety disorder?
So I would look at it as it could be I wouldn't say really it falls into either being a precursor or a result. I think that anxiety has a way of shifting its forms. So I have seen where somebody might sort of present and have something that seems like a social anxiety, but it can develop into, you know, then kind of compulsions come into the mix, and it in the presentation can change. I don't know that one leads to the other, and somebody might disagree with me on that, but I would say that they're different things. The anxieties in and of themselves tend to manifest in different ways, so it's one of those things to look out for once you are doing exposure in one context. It's always good to then mix that up, because I date myself by sometimes with our kids using the term whack-a-mole, and I say it's sort of like whack-a-mole, where it'll pop up somewhere else and maybe in a little bit of a different form. And they say, "What's that?" Because they don't go to the arcade anymore. They have the arcade on their Xbox, and yeah, it's way better than any arcade I went to. So I think it can change and evolve, but I don't know that one leads to the other.
In Mountain Valley, you know, I feel like parents play a pretty big role. And Alan was joking me earlier about my own anxiety with Eden dropping her off. But there is something to say about that and the way parents kind of handle anxiety and with their kids. What's Mountain Valley's kind of approach to the parents?
I'll tell you, I was at a talk the other day, and somebody asked, "Well, so is it nature or nurture?" And this expert that was standing up there said, "Well, it doesn't matter. Both are your fault," to the parent. Just a little clinical joke for you. So I think that parents play a huge role. We have a parent component to our treatment at Mountain Valley. So we would more call it parent coaching. And so, because we get kids from all over, just because we're in New Hampshire, we'll get kids from outside of the country. We get kids from all over the U.S. And so since parents might not be close by, we do a lot of our coaching via Skype. And being a short-term program, kind of 60 to 90 days, it's hard to really get into kind of deeper issues. So what we focus on is that sort of the family accommodation piece. So exploring ways that parents, while totally well-meaning, may be actually accommodating and fostering the anxiety. And so we will, the first step is we send parents a PowerPoint that we've designed on family accommodation. And so they read through that, and it starts a conversation. And typically it's a very interesting conversation, because parents will say, "Wait a second, you mean I've been doing this thing, and it's, you know, so I've been, you know, saying that my kid doesn't like heights and can't do heights, and I've really actually been maintaining that anxiety of heights. You mean I need to take them on bridges, and we need to go do these things once they, you know, complete treatment at Mountain Valley?" And their therapist will say, "That's exactly what I'm saying." And we're really looking to, and we'll have family sessions that are both independent without the kid and then with the kid included. And the kid or resident will be working with their therapist to become their own exposure coach, their own anxiety specialist. And we'll get kids who, because typically our kids, you know, to use really clinically savvy terms, our kids are sweet kids. They're mm-hmm. smart kids. They're just scared. Mm-hmm. And once they start to get a little bit of traction and feel a little bit better from this anxiety, they've made friends at Mountain Valley, you know, maybe they haven't had friends before, and they're feeling good when they leave, they actually will start to coach their parents, and they'll say, you know, this thing will make me a little bit anxious. Why don't I go do this? I'm going to go do this thing. You wait here, Mom and Dad. I need to be away. You know, before I was stuck to you, I need to be a little bit away. I'm going to go across the street and go get dinner by myself. And so they'll start to embrace and coach their parents on kind of what they need to do. And it's where, you know, back to the point talking about therapists who will be trained in exposure and continue this treatment. It's one thing that we do sort of for discharge from Mountain Valley is we're looking for therapists all the time who can continue this treatment.
Right. Yeah, you know, as you were telling that story, and it was reminding me of a case that I was on, and as most people know, we do the adolescent transport to bring young people to programs like yours. And many years ago, as I was taking someone to a program, and I was arriving, I was supposed to be there at 9 o'clock in the morning. I actually arrived at about 7, and they said, well, you know, the people that you're going to see aren't here yet, but we'd like, why don't you go have breakfast with the rest of the kids? I said, okay, great. So we went out and we sat down, and quite a few of the kids came up and sat next to us, and they said, oh, you must be transporting him in. What did he do? And I said, why would you assume that? And they said, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, he's actually bringing me in. I said, you know, the new construction that's going on just up over the hill, it's actually going to be a program for parents dealing with some of the same issues. And in unison, about 15 kids sitting around us all blurted out at the same time, how do I get my parents in there now?
amazing.
Yes, but I love the fact, as you're talking about the, you know, this sort of way in which we are influencing each other in these situations, that, you know, communicate with your child, you know what it is that they're thinking, and know what it is that you may be doing to contribute to some of the things that aren't going so well.
And that could be incredibly hard, because as the sort of family system, you fall into patterns, and sometimes I think that's one of the magic with Mountain Valley or just residential treatment in general, is to get away, to mix up that family system is important. And it's something that then people can kind of take a breath and reevaluate what's going on. And so once you take kind of a step back and take a look at you know, how things were, you know, what was going right and what was going wrong, that's a really helpful activity.
And you're talking about family dynamics and roles, and I'm curious, you know, we all play a role, and the adolescent that you get at Mountain View has played this role in their family for a long time. Is there any interesting stories or any dynamic differences when they return home that other people take on that role as holding the anxiety in the family, or does it change, or what happens?
That's a good question. I don't know about anybody else in the family kind of taking on that role. I do know that we've had, I've talked to residents that I've worked with who've gone home and, you know, they'll say to me, oh, well, now, kind of what you were saying before, I need to send my parents to Mountain Valley because they're having trouble sort of coaching the parents along now that they are back home. And that can be a difficult thing. So often I will encourage that there is some family work that continues on, because you don't want sort of the good work that has gone on at Mountain Valley to sort of be overshadowed by whatever is going on at home. And sometimes going home isn't sort of setting someone up for success, and so we might want to recommend that the system get really changed, and so maybe it's a boarding school, or that maybe a kid changes from a really big public school that they were at to just a smaller school with a little bit more support.
Now, you just mentioned the word success, and many people that listen to the show know that it is one of the things that we love the most. So if you could share with us, and I'm sure you have many, but one of your favorite success stories. And what I found is that when I hear back from parents, parents that call us afterwards or they email us, they love the success stories because in many cases, they'll see their child as being someone who may have some of the same issues and can't really vision a success coming out of that. So I think if you can share some, it's so beneficial to many of the parents out there listening.
Sure. I worked with a young individual recently who had not been out of the house or actually had not been attending school for a year and a half. And had not been probably out of the house in, I don't know, more than 6 months. And the world had just been sort of getting smaller and smaller and basically was playing video games all day long, not because sort of obsessed with video games, but just because if you're staying at home kind of alone and there's nothing else to do, that sort of takes up the time. And he stayed with us and did really good work with us, basically getting out, interacting with other kids, really sort of digging into the social exposure because a lot of the fear kind of revolved around being judged. And so, you know, that gets the therapist to do all kinds of fun things with kids where they get to do all sorts of wacky things that you might think they would sort of make fools of themselves. But it turns out, you know, it's all okay. And in fact, people will like you for it and you get sort of praised for it. And so this young individual, one of the things that stuck with me was sitting at his graduation and I'm looking around the room saying, you know, for really a year and a half before I got here, I didn't have much social interaction. And I hear a lot of people graduating from this program and they say that, you know, they had a lot of friends and then they got there's crippling anxiety, and so they lost touch with all their friends, and then they came to Mountain Valley, and so now they have the tools to go back and engage with their friends, and they're excited to do that and build those relationships. And he said, you know, I really didn't have any friends before I came here. I never really had any friends. And looked around the room and said, and now I have friends. Thank you for being my friends. And I know I'll make more. And it was just this, you know, it was like a really, really satisfying, emotional time for everyone involved. And I've spoken to him since on the phone, and he is now attending school and working on making friends and had switched schools, so had a daunting experience there, so we had to do a lot of prep work for it, but has since made it to school and is doing well.
Well, and that's beautiful, and that's one of the reasons why we do what we do. But in that particular situation, and I happened to look, and we only have about a minute left, in that particular situation, it sounds like there may have also been an issue with depression. Was that something you had to address as well?
Yeah, so that's for the next episode.
But okay.
there is a lot of comorbid issues that come in with anxiety. And so, just think about your world shrinking because you're anxious to do things. Yes, depression is sort of an inevitable, they go hand in hand. So it's something that comes in, and sometimes it's a little chicken and egg kind of a thing, but depression is something that a lot of our kids will be struggling with.
Well, we really want to thank you for coming on, Dr. Young. The program is Mountain Valley Treatment Center. The website, www.mountainvalleytreatment.org. Please reach out to them, and we want to thank all of our listeners. And please be sure to put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday, August 29th, when our guest, Christine Halverson, nationally recognized blogger, will join us to discuss raising a happy teen.
And if you missed or you want to share our show, this show, or any of the past shows with your friends, please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com. You may also subscribe or resubmit your name to download your free copy of The Attitude of Gratitude Journal, your 21-day guide to achieve the quality of thankfulness through self-discovery.
And the next time you're on Facebook and Twitter, please remember to stop by our page and check some of our latest posts. And if you like them, please like us and spread the word.
And so, Dr. Alex Young, thank you so much for being with us. And for everybody out
there. Thanks for having me.
And for everybody out there, thank you for listening. Be good human beings and be with us again next week for Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.